USA, USA, USA. That's right. Welcome back to another episode of Political Football, episode 14, Fire and Brimstone. We've had a bit of a hiatus, a two-week hiatus, but that's neither here nor there. It's a big day, in some say, in the making of the world, given that the US election is being held today. Joe Biden going up against the incumbent president, Donald J. Trump, and going into Origin tonight. It's fitting that we are recording an episode, but we actually are focusing on the bushfire or the Royal Commission into Natural Disasters, which sort of specifically focus on bushfires as one of the key areas. But before we get to that, just your key prediction, Joe, for the US election. Where will it be won and lost, and what are you looking for in the early results that come through this afternoon?
Look, mate, I'm all over it today. But in terms of prediction, I mean, I tried to predict the last election in America, and that went horribly wrong. So, I mean, I'd like to, out of everyone you talk to and everything you see all over social media and everything, there's more Biden materials in support of him than there is of Trump. So you'd like to think that is kind of a predictor, but at the same time, all these Trump supporters come out of the woodwork, it seems, when voting comes around. So I'm honestly hung out. I can't tell you who I think's going to win. I think it could go either way, and I think it will go either way. So.
Yeah, and as you know, I'm a man of hard facts, and I don't like to deal in speculation. I like to deal in facts.
Good man.
But if you look at the key states here, we look at places like Michigan, Wisconsin, the Rust Belt up there, and North Carolina is going to be a big early indicator. If Biden carries that, then he's more than likely going to win. I see Florida, I've just seen some early results. It's like 49-48, but that's still only, I think, 30% of their vote counted. Biden just ahead in there. So Florida, if he wins Florida, then he's probably guaranteed to win the election. So they're the early signs there. And just in terms of general trends, we've seen huge voter turnout. I think like prior early voting, which is obviously going to be high due to Corona and how much it's impacted over there, it was already 107% of the people who voted in 2016, which so that sort of 2016 level was people didn't turn out to vote for Hillary Clinton because they thought she was going to win. Whereas this time people have actually turned out. And I think it's like 80, maybe 90%, I think I saw in a exit poll earlier today that said they already made the decision before mid-September. So in other words, there was a lot more volatility in 2016. It's been train tracks all this period of time. But that's leave it there. We'll let the results speak for themselves. But that's our early thoughts on that. But getting into our first major topic of the week, as we prefer here at Political Football, policy over politics. We're driven by improving societal outcomes for the everyman. Last week, Joe, the Royal Commission into Natural Disasters, they released a report, 1,000 pages, 600 pages of report, some pages of recommendations, and a large appendix totaling 1,000 pages. So a huge turnaround, and especially going that we're on the brink, we're staring down the brink of another bushfire season. It's especially important that we take the lessons of the last bushfire season, because bushfire seasons are only going to get worse as the risk of bushfire season is only going to get worse as we go along. Joe, do you want to run us through the key recommendations that the Royal Commission put through?
So yeah, I'll just list off these couple of things now, and then we'll get into it of our thoughts on what they came up with. So a few of them are, they want to create a national-wide water bombing fleet. They want to establish a national resilience and recovery body. They want to improve understanding about fuel management, land planning and use, and hazard reduction burns. They want to create the power of the federal government to call a national emergency. They want to urgently deliver a new Australian warning system for all disasters, putting a large focus on a plan that is a whole government. For example, housing regulations in coastal areas, plans from the federal level filtered all the way down through the local government implementation. And a commission cited evidence that Australia has warmed by 1.4 degrees since the 1910s, with the last year being the hottest on record. So essentially, these are a lot of things here on the list I've felt have been things I've talked about over the course of my uni degree. I've been in geography courses, and we discuss a whole lot of these things, so it's good to actually finally see them wanting to be recognised on a national scale? What do you think? What do you think?
Yeah, I think these are all sensible sort of recommendations. Like each individually, like probably mentioned throughout the bushfire crisis, I know there was a lot of conjecture about a national water bombing fleet. You know, I think New South Wales only has like one 737 air bomber. But like comparatively, look at California, they've got 14 as well as a variety of other small and medium sized aircraft that attack their fires in terms of preventing their, you know, their spread, and obviously using things like fire retardant and all that sort of stuff. So I think, you know, they're sensible, and things like streamlining things, because in Australia, what people say as compared different to New Zealand is that there's three distinct levels of government that each have a very unique, also very distinct set of responsibilities. So the last thing you want is where you want blame shifting or responsibility and nothing actually getting done. So things like the power for the federal government to call a national emergency is key. So like when the bushfires, they don't respect state borderlines. You know, they cross over, you know, they're on the border of New South Wales and Victoria, up on the north coast in Queensland, South Victoria, South Australia border. So that ability for the federal government to step in and not necessarily sort of take over the resources, but to actually call a national emergency in terms of the response unit. So things like getting the ADF in for a faster response where needed, so people aren't stranded or if they lose communication, those sort of things that can be really important. But yeah, sort of, and things like understanding of land planning and use and fuel management. These are quite, I think people say, oh, you know, one of the points I was put forward earlier this year was saying, oh, you know, because there's too much regulation around back burning and that sort of stuff. Whereas the report actually says hazard reduction burning, it only plays a very small part of a much larger scheme in terms of the role of climate going forward. So I know, Joe, you said you wanted to make a couple of extra points there that potentially could be included going forward in terms of land management and prevention.
Yeah, I mean, well, like, it's been in front of us for how long that Indigenous land use systems, land management systems in place have governed the Australian bush for tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years. So, like, the answers can be right in front of us. It just comes down to a bit of communication and taking people more seriously. Whether or not that is going to completely stop the fires in the tracks when the fires come around is up to, I mean, us to test and see for the future. But, I mean, we talk about this, how we can involve our Indigenous communities more and more and more, but the answers are right there. We're just not attacking them. So land management's good, but I want to see more communication between the Indigenous communities and the elders. I think there's a lot of good information we can share between each other. But if I go back to something like creating a national water bombing fleet, that stands out to me as a good immediate relief. But, you know, I think there needs to be some way to repurpose those planes when it's not bushfire season. So we're not creating excess planes or materials to fight fire, and then they're just sitting there for what might be 2 or 3 years for some of the materials to get used. So if that can be done where the materials repurposed throughout the year for other things, then I think that's definitely a way to go. But if we're going to create billions of dollars worth of material to fight fires and we only get a severe fire season every couple of years, like every few years, I want to see that money put to better use for repurposing. But there's still a couple of great things on here. But also things, yeah, like I've said, have just been on everyone's minds and on everyone's tongues for years. And I'm glad they're finally being put into the spotlight, like wanting to recognise that Australia's warmed by 1.4 degrees. Like, there's a lot of talk about climate change for the past 10, 15 years. But I'm glad we're finally starting at small steps rather than tackling climate change as one total massive issue. We're just stepping down to acknowledging a 1.4 degree rise. Like, that's a place to start, a place to start getting people to acknowledge what's happening around them in their environment and why it's and how it's causing further issues like the bushfire seasons.
And I think you've made a lot of good points there, and I've got to respect that. But the you nailed on the head in terms of the recommendations. A lot of them are adaptation measures. And we talk about the response to, because in the report, climate was mentioned about 350 times, but in the actual recommendations, there wasn't that many two climate-related ones. So a lot of it was about adaptation, not necessarily about mitigation. So, I mean, with climate, the next 20 years, regardless if we stop burning fossil fuels or, you know, got to net zero tomorrow, the next, like, 20 years of climate are effectively locked in, you know. So there is a role for adaptation, and I'm glad it recommends that. But it goes back to the terms of reference. As you said, we've sort of known about these things and what we can actually do to attack bushfires. And that goes back to the whole nature of how government responds to these sort of crises in the first point. Yeah, I read an interesting stat the other day. There's been something close to 60 inquiries by the federal and state government since 1930 into bushfire prevention and necessary requirements around that. Now, that's one every couple of years. You just wonder how many reports is too much. You know, like, is it just a report for sake of reporting? You know, there seems to be this ever-increasing approach from government where something goes wrong in a sector or a place of society, and there's a Royal Commission into it, you know, because there's public outrage. You know, we've seen Royal Commissions into aged care, into institutional child abuse, the financial sector, now the bushfires. But not many of those actual recommendations have gone forward and been implemented. Mm. And so it becomes this everlasting cycle that they put these Royal Commissions in to appease some sort of placebo effect of, you know, making sure they're taking action. But when it comes to the crunch, that they're not actually going ahead and manifesting these things. So that's one of the large concerns about here. And, you know, the terms of reference, a lot of these, you know, I was listening to a podcast, Democracy Sausage. Well, friends down there at ANU in Canberra, is a Canberra boy. They said the report addresses the symptoms and not the causes. Mm. And you've got to get to the crux of these issues and the causes. And we know what they are. You know, we've never lived in a more informed society as to what these things occur. And we get more and more information by the day. But these things need to be implemented, and it's just not good enough to be handing down these reports without actually following it through into delivery.
Yeah, I mean, what's it worth without action? What are the 1,000 pages of words worth if there's no action? It's just a waste of everyone's time, especially the people who put those papers together. But another thing I realise in my own personal experience being caught up in a bit of the bushfire damage down in Naruma on the far New South Wales south coast, in 2019, 20 summer, was the education on what's happening on the fire. So it's not, I guess, a lot of people put responsibility on the government, and that's huge because they're the ones who can help fix things and stop it from happening to an extent. But I think a huge part of it also is educating people on what the fire is and why it's happening and how it's happening. Like, a lot of people freak out about the fire, which is fair because it's ravaging land and houses and taking things away from people. But people need to understand that the country's going to burn, and it has to. The country has to burn to self-maintain. That's how all of our flora and fauna is set up. It's like, it's a natural process. So if we can educate people on that, it might lead more people to make rational decisions in these times, because not only is the government trying to work out how to fight the fire and maintain it, but when you have a whole bunch of people not making rational decisions and causing a whole bunch of other drama that's completely human related, it takes a lot of focus from the actual issue of fighting the fire. So I think there needs to be more in terms of educating people on the fires, whether that starts from the school ages, or whether that's outside of school, more just public education out on the street or whatever, seminars or anything. I think we can all benefit from knowing more. Whether that is going to stop it or fix it or save it, I don't know. But if we all know more when these situations come back around, we might all have a better chance to recommend how it can be better.
Yeah, and I think it goes to a key point there. And I love the fact that you bring up that educational point, given your grounding in that space, is that the more you're invested in an issue and the more that you know about it, the more empowered that you feel to take action. So that is at the crux. And now I was recently watching, I'm not sure if you've caught up with Craig Rucastle's Big Weather on the ABC, but he had a great series earlier this year about climate change itself. But this one was actually looking at our response to big weather events, whether it be large cells, storms, bushfires, floods, whatever it may be. And he went to a local community, I think in Victoria, that was actually badly affected by the Black Saturday fires back in, I think, 2010, I think it was. Don't quote me on that, I think it's 2010. But obviously, some quite a long time ago. You know, 170 people plus died on the weekend of that, on the Black Saturday. And so these kids who have grown up now have sort of come up and sort of grown up in the ravages and in the background of these ravaged communities that were hit by the bushfires. And they've actually, in some of the local schools, they're putting like the RFS and the Country Fire Service down there have actually worked with the school kids on how they can actually become aware and educated in these programs. So it's a combination of a top-down policy approach that enables and has a coherent policy. So things like the national body in relation to climate resilience and in natural disasters and that sort of thing, and a national warning system, so you don't have one person on one side of the state getting a warning for a bushfire that's close to them, as opposed to someone who lives a couple of hundred metres away on the other side of the state border. So those sort of things come down. But you've also got to make use of that local knowledge and the state level knowledge that happens, because that's imperative knowledge that people have. You know, people volunteering with the local RFS, you know, national parks and wildlife services, they all have a role to play. So that's why it goes back to, and I really like the point that the Royal Commission makes, in that it needs to be a whole of government approach, because that's where you see the biggest gains. Yep. Not people complaining with conflicting and different interests, as we've seen in the past, right? So everyone might have a different goal and want to achieve something, but when everyone's on the same page and working towards the same goal and has the same sort of objectives, then a lot more can be gained in terms of that. So any final points on that, Joe, before we move on to our sports section? I think we've done a pretty good job.
Yeah, I think you know, we just got to drill home action, putting action to words and just not pumping out report after report or information bundle after information bundle about how we can fix things and how we can do things. Because as I've said plenty of times already today, we've known a lot of these things that we can do for a long time. So it's time to put money where the mouth is and actually put action to words, I think.
Well, there you go. Couldn't have said it better myself. I hope that debate enlightens people. I know it's been a crazy couple of weeks generally, and this sort of thing, like in Royal Commission of Bushfires and natural disasters, can be missed in the rapid news cycle. But that's why we wanted to cover today, because as we are here at Political Football, we always want to cover policy from a solutions-based perspective. And I hope that this sort of debate around it has enabled our listeners to become more empowered and more informed on this issue. But we'll be back shortly with our sports coverage. A big week of sport this week, obviously, with grand finals last week, but we'll give our reflections on that and what that means for Melbourne and Penrith going forward. We'll also give our State of Origin preview game one tonight. I feel like it's been an eternity since the last Origin game, but good things come to those who wait. And then finally, we'll play a little bit of Moneyball, a little surveying the market. We'll see the big off-field sort of acquisitions for this coming 2021 season and who's still on the market and where their potential landing spots may be.
Mate versus mate. State versus state. This is Origin, baby. It doesn't get any better. People describe war-like situations. Well, that's exactly what State of Origin is. Tune in tonight, Channel 9, 7:30, prime time Origin. It doesn't get any better than this.
And there we go. That's a little snap back from the grand final there. And hopefully I can say Vunivalu's name right, unlike Rabbits Warren Vunivalo. But massive part of the grand final. That put the Storm up 16-0 inevitably after the kick. Essentially almost putting the Panthers to bed. And I mean, I know we saw a late Panthers comeback, but we'll get into that on our grand final analysis right here. So welcome back to Political Football. Pools, grand final review. What was your thoughts on the game, mate? Because I know I have a strong little piece to share for everyone. But
I'm looking forward to that. But first, a little precursor. Look, I was to give you a bit of context, I spent the day at Ballina RSL. Now, I was looking forward to it. Obviously, up there in one, you know, there's many God's countries in Australia. Many say the whole country is God's country, but that's certainly one little pocket of it. And I wasn't sure, when you go to RSL, sort of place for a grand final day in Sydney, you think it'd be packed, especially with the COVID restrictions. So we decided to get there about 1:30 in the afternoon. So I was sinking a few tinnies, sinking a few news over the course of the day, and the anticipation built. It did feel quite long. I had a couple of bets here and there. Mum was slapping away in the pokies. But gamble responsibly, as they say. But the anticipation built. And again, I'm not sure. I just became sort of caught up in the process of being invested in Penrith, you know. As I said, I predicted earlier this year in political football that one of the Western Sydney teams would win. So perhaps a little mini Nostradamus. That's what I was rooting for in the end. I just didn't want Melbourne to get another victory, because effectively they got to the sort of advantageous position that they are because they cheated the salary cap systematically. But that's neither here nor there. That's just a bit of background context. So I was highly anticipated. And then I think Gus Gould's commentary was a little overhyped. That's
shocking, mate.
But I did think Penrith, you know, were matching it with the Storm. It was just that every time Storm had a half opportunity in that first half, they scored. And that was the key thing. If Penrith kept them to 16 or to 12 points in that first half, then I think they would definitely go on to win the game. But the fact that they let it to get to 20, like Appy Coruscant playing at Cam Smith's hand with, 5 seconds to go in that first half, you would back your defence in there to stop the try in that situation, you know, and he knocked it out, and then Cam Smith picks up and scored one of the arsiest tries in a grand final you'll see. The penalty try, it probably was a penalty try, but still, you know, those sort of 50-50 things that went that way. Cleary throwing the long, as we said, the Vinivalu ball over the top. He went with the end over end. It's a little pet hate of mine. It's one of them sort of throw a spiral, because the spiral is much harder. Those little floaters, you know, the up and in defence can get up there and get in the channel and read. Where if you throw a spiral, you know, I think it's more accurate and it can hit a target, and it's certainly much more harder to intercept. And then the Pappenhausen try after half time, you know, Cleary and Liam Martin just looked at the guy coming back for the unders ball, and Pappenhausen doesn't need much space and just took off. You know, and you just felt at that point in time that it was just too great an obstacle to come back. And then, you know, they scored their first try in the 67th minute, which is, they just ran out of time. But they nearly got there. They even gave themselves one last opportunity with 3 seconds to go after Cleary scored that nice individual try. But it was just a very frustrating grand final. Now, like for me, I couldn't think of a worse last 4 year of grand finals with two Storms and two Roosters grand final wins.
Mm.
It really, really bugged. It's one of the bigger.
Nah, not what I want to see, mate. But I want to start by saying it was an incredibly disappointing grand final for me personally. Not because the Storm won, because I honestly, if it's a great grand final and my team's not playing, I don't care who wins. I want it to be a good game.
As Stephen Hayward would say, we don't care.
We don't care. But I think the game was incredibly disappointing compared to how the rest of the final series went. The rest of the final series was super competitive, highly exciting, like crazy energy from the onset, right? From the first round of the finals. The grand final was completely controlled from the beginning of the game. There was like disappointing calls. The penalty try, in my opinion, was not a penalty try. His legs were there before he went to put the ball down. He didn't swing in. That is my opinion, but it's neither here nor there. It's happened. But I just think the game was so controlled in the first 20 minutes. The penalty count, the reffing, like you just let the boys play. Let the boys play.
Let the boys play.
But I know that's a bit cliche to complain about reffing, because I personally get a bit, you know, tired of people who just complain about refs. But it's the biggest game of the year. It's what everyone's been looking forward to since the NRL came back after COVID, the COVID little breakdown period. But and it was just controlled out of the gate. Penrith, I feel like they had a bit in them in the first half, but they just kept getting knocked back. And I mean, they did make their fair share of silly mistakes, but at the same time, they were just being held back, not allowed to gain some momentum. Game kept stopping. It was just like, it was a mess, in my opinion. Pretty, very disappointing grand final. But yeah, but you can't take it away from the Storm, you know? Like, I guess if it's a disappointing game, reffing wise, the two teams still are on the same platform, but so they made the most of their chances, and you can't take that away from them, and they have some amazing players who pulled off some amazing things. But I'd like to see that rerun, and I just hope Penrith get themselves another chance because they deserve it there.
Yeah, for sure. And that doesn't mean, because you can't win them all, as they say, as Penrith found out on they lost the one that counted the most. And if you're a Penrith fan, imagine how that feels. You won 17 in a row and you lose. I sort of compare it to the Patriots and 07, for those of our listeners who follow a bit of NFL, when Brady and Randy Moss were lighting it up, then lost the Super Bowl to Eli Manning and the Giants. But moving on now, I think that we can park that one to the side, and we move on now to something perhaps that will fill us with a little bit more joy.
Let's go!
That is State of Origin, state versus state, mate versus mate, as Phil Gould used to say in his little pump up previews.
God, I hope that doesn't happen tonight.
Yeah.
I'm so sick of Phil Gould.
Let's go! But yeah, moving on now to our preview. Joe, simple question. Where do you think this game will be won? Where do you think it'll be lost?
You know me, mate. Up the guts and into them. I mean, it's an Origin game, so you've got the best players of both states playing against each other. So they're going to use their forward packs as much as they can. And especially for New South Wales, they've got some damaging forwards there. In Paulo, specifically, my Parramatta friend. But up the middle. I mean, like we've seen in other Origin backs, I wouldn't be surprised if the first half is just an onslaught of forwards. It's just a heavy hit out in the middle, and then I wouldn't be surprised if in the later stages of the second half, last 20 minutes, if we start to see the ball thrown around, because we've got some bloody good players, bloody exciting players, especially New South Wales are brought in, who can throw the ball around and got a lot of speed out the back. So I think the first 50 to 60 minutes will be all up the middle, and then I reckon the last 20 minutes the ball will get thrown around a lot. We'll see a lot of exciting play from both teams, realistically.
Yeah, man, I think people have got carried away, like looking at the Queensland back line and saying, oh, you know, like it's a bunch of rookies and a bunch of people that wouldn't be there if they had a full strength team, like people like Brinko Lee, Phil Semi, and Xavier Coates. I don't think you can argue with Alex Brimson's inclusion, AJ as they call him, up in the Gold Coast area. But if we just go back to the forward pack, and I think this will be a key battle. Like, the Queensland forward pack is very robust and strong. They've got Christian Welch, who was one of the form forwards of the final series and done a job for Storm for a couple of years now. You've got Josh Papali, who's a big bopper in the set. We know he's one of the most destructive forwards in the game. Not sure what he's going on there with his little haircut there in the photo, in his little biopic. And you've got Felice Kafusi, obviously Melbourne Storm, Juggernaut, and Tino Fasomalawi. These guys are gun. And then you've got Jairo, Lindsay Collins, and Jaden Sewer off the bench. I mean, that's a pretty good bench for the Maroons too. So as long as, I'd say, if New South Wales can match it, or if they can beat them, you know, they've got their own sort of pack as well, with Saifidi, Paulo, Corner, Frizzell, Trbojevic, and then Cameron Murray, Crichton, Haas off the bench. I mean, there could be a few holes in that in terms of, I'm not sure about Daniel Saifidi. His form towards the back end of the season was a little hit and miss, like the Newcastle form. And even like Payne Haas now, Payne Haas is a good player in a bad team. But is his confidence going to be up there? And I just think that this game will be close. Like an Origin game is, you know, they're always pretty close. But if New South Wales can match it in the forward pack, then you can't really question the class. The back line is sensational. You know, you could put two or three back lines in for New South Wales that would be elite. And this is just one version of it, even without the inclusion of David Nofaluma. As I've mentioned before, that'll earth me to the grave. But yeah, your thoughts on the Haas pairing here, Keary and Cleary, a bit of a rhyme there, against Munster, the Sesh Munster, and DCE the flop.
I will get to that, because that's one thing I did want to talk about, but I'll just touch on a few things you mentioned too. I do think there's a couple concerns in the Queensland back line. I'm not worried about Brimson or Coates in terms of them being suitable, because I think they can turn up and they can play well. I am worried about Branko Lee. I mean, you know.
We saw what Critter did to him in that grand final.
It's a straightforward just, like, prediction that New South Wales are just going to slam it down his side all night, right? I mean, because Dane Gagai is not, he's not an easy opponent. Like, he's stood his ground in Origin. He's stood his ground all year for the Rabbits. He had an unreal year, and he's good in that centre position. But, yeah, I think the Blues are just going to jam it down Branko Lee's side the whole night. But, yeah, as for the rest of the team, Munster and Cherry Evans, they've been two of the best halves in the league for a few years now, so there's no worries there. And then the Queensland forward pack, they're all fundamentally drilled, great, low mistake-making players. So I'm a bit interested on how they put Tino starting over Jai Arrow. I thought that's a bit of a risk there, especially because there's a couple of weaknesses in the back line. I thought Arrow would definitely get in based on his defensive ability. But maybe they just want to pump that young blood in their first game, get a bit of experience under his belt. But yeah, coming back to the New South Wales halves, I don't think anyone could argue with this pairing here. The two have earned it all year. I'm glad to see Cody Walker coming off the bench there. I think he might come on as that, kind of what they were doing there with Tyrone Peachy for a few years. They were bringing him off the bench, bit of speed, bit of electricity, get around the tide forward. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see Cody Walker come on with about 20 minutes to go, get the ball thrown around and make some speed on the outside. But yeah, touching on your points from a couple of the seemingly surprising lists for the Blues, the Payne Haas selection, I mean, you can't. He's a great young player, but based off how the Broncos went this year and his impact on the game, I think, you probably could have, and I mean, I'm a bit biased, but Regan Campbell-Gillard to come off the bench there probably would have been a more suitable choice for me. But, you know, we'll see how we go tonight. And I think New South Wales maybe could have noticed a couple of weaknesses in the Queensland team and use that as an opportunity to play some of those players to get some more experience under their belt.
Sure.
But then again, you always have to take Queensland serious. I mean, they bleed rugby league up there, so.
Yeah. And your prediction for this game, before we move on to our final topic for sport this week, your prediction for this game, who wins and by how much?
I think Blues win. I think they control the game for the most part, but I don't think they smash them. I think it's a 10-point game. I'm thinking maybe a 24-14 sort of style game. I think couple tries in the first half, maybe kind of even in the first half, and then I think we'll see a bit of an onslaught in the second half from both sides, and they'll cross the line a few times each. So,
well, as I say in the classics, great minds think alike. I was thinking along the 10-point victory as well for New South Wales, something along the line again, like 26-16, would be easy to picture in this game. But yeah, I think that's a pretty holistic wrap up of the preview. Again, we'll have a much better insight into the state of the affairs of the teams after this game.
That's right, too, because we've never seen Origin at this time of year. We don't know. We got some young players on that Queensland team. They didn't see much of the grass during the season, so they might be fresher, ready to go than some of those key players like Cordner and Tyson Frizzell, who could be a bit more banged up from a big year. So,
and even the whole nature of having back-to-back-to-back Origins, you know, you're in a bubble again for another 3 weeks. Will players who played in final series, will they be more affected by that because, you know, they haven't been out, chance of being outside because they had to continue to be in the bubble, whereas some, you know, Queensland players probably had the chance to get out and then come back in. So
I'm playing three grand finals in a row, it's not going to be easy for any of the players. But I think there again is where we see New South Wales' edge, because they have so much depth in that squad, where like if anyone goes out of that team, you've got another star player to come and fill the spot. So I think New South Wales have the edge there based on the 3 week back-to-back schedule. But for as long as I've been alive, you can never count Queensland out of a game. Their spirit and
you could argue that Queensland makes Origin because of how much it sort of means to them.
Absolutely, mate. Absolutely.
That sort of Queenslander attitude with that Billy Moore in the 90s. But moving on now to our final segment of the weekend. Now that the NRL season is officially done and dusted, that brings big heroes like myself out into the world to survey the market and say, give us a bit of hope in terms of who we could secure the services going forward. Now, I know we play a bit of fantasy football. It's always been an idea of mine to play hypotheticals.
Guess who you're versing this week, mate?
yourself?
Let's go.
Poundtown Doves after our huge 156-point performance last week. DK and the boys getting it done in Seattle, and you got to respect that. But I don't want to go a bit off topic, get a bit niche there. But let's go through some of the players that have been talked about it being on the market or on the move. Some players for next year, some players that can now negotiate for 2022. First one off the rink, Josh Mansour. Now, he's been told by the director of football and Ivan Cleary out there in Penrith that he will not be starting in 2021 at the foot of the mountains because they've got Charlie Staines, who they've re-signed, and obviously Brian To'o into the team. So that was... that's an interesting point there. What do you think? What do you think one of his landing destinations may be?
Oh man, I mean it's a bit rough for old Josh. You know, yeah, veteran leader on a team, and they go to a grand final, and he gets his chance. But you know what I mean? It's still a business, and they've got hopes for the future there in Penrith. They got a young squad, so they're backing their young stars. So you can't. Be too mad at Penrith for making that decision, but I think any team looking for a bit of leadership would be very lucky to pick up Mansour. So, but then again, I would not be surprised if you just see an already title contending team just pick him up as a bit of extra power on the wing there. Like he's not ridiculous, and he's not game changing as much anymore.
But he's reliable.
But he's reliable. He's got experience. He's now played in the grand final. He's a valuable player. So I wouldn't be surprised if you see someone like Melbourne. Well, I mean, Melbourne have been talking about it because of Addo Carr's leaving. So slot in another grand final playing veteran into that team, and yeah, he can still cause damage on another team. So I wouldn't be surprised if he gets signed by an already contending team.
One team that I'd like to see him at that I think it could be a good match would be the Canterbury Bankstown Bulldogs. Mm. I think it'd be a bit of leadership there. He's a genuine first grader, you know, and on the wing. I know they've got Vitenis Lesniak and Remus Smith, but Remus Smith seems to... There's rumours he might be going to Melbourne.
You never know what the Raiders could do either. They're losing Nick Kotrick, and their other winger is a rookie young Fijian bloke who is a good player, but they're losing an Origin winger. So you never know what Raiders are going to do down there. And Raiders are coming up as a bit of a desirable destination for a Fred.
And a few years ago, when Tedesco was talking about going to Canberra, I remember he did tour of the facilities with Josh Mansour down there. But in terms of the reasoning, I like to see him at the Bulldogs, more of a sort of a cultural reason as well. We know the Bulldogs have a large Lebanese following community. Mm. A lot of the boys I went to school with, you know, they bleed the blue and white of Belmore. And I could see him fitting in there. Obviously, we know he's a role model in the Lebanese community, and I think it would be quite a nice matchup. But again, remember, Trent Barrett is a new incoming coach, and obviously he was at Penrith this year as part of their success. So that's something I like to see, and I think that would be a great fit both off and on the field. And so I think that's a good place. So there you go, either potentially the Bulldogs or a title contending team like Melbourne or Canberra being possible fits for him. But moving on to our second one here. Now, he's contacted the Penrith Panthers again for 2021, and they're keen to see that out, and I think he'll stay there. But for 2022, he's hitting the open market, and Trent Barrett has made no sort of secret of the fact that he wants Matt Burden at Canterbury Bankstown in 2022. I dare say Canterbury will try and blow Penrith out of the water with the offer there. And it comes down to Penrith that you can't keep Luai and you can't keep Burden, you know, because they both want to play six. I think they'll have to let him go to the Bulldogs. Your thoughts on Burden?
Yeah, I mean, it's a rough situation, but you have to stick with Luai after what Luai's done. I mean, it's rough, you know, when two players want the one position and they're not willing to really step down and let another player in the way. In the ultimate aims of winning a championship. So it's tough for those two players, but yeah, I'd take Luai over Burton.
Yeah. And that's the beauty of the market, right? It's one of the machinations of it. You know, sometimes you're going to have players who are both quality and could live up to the task of being first grade players, but it comes down to a choice of who you want. And usually the incumbent who's performed there over the sort of young and up-and-coming will get the go, and that young up-and-coming will have to go somewhere else, like we see like with Ryan Pappenhausen. But moving on now to Bryce Cartwright. Now, I wouldn't exactly call him a marquee player like he was when he signed with the Gold Coast Titans, but he's setting a bit of a reset in his career, and I've got to respect that. he signed a 1-year deal with Penrith. I'd say pretty close to a minimum wage deal, but oh, sorry, with Para. Sorry, mine's all over the place there. With Para. So Joe obviously is a Para fan. What do you see this deal? Is it worthwhile? Is it giving him a shot? Or what do you see him fitting into the equation?
Look, mate, Bryce Cartwright is the Bryce Cartwright signing for Para.
There you go. Bit of play on words there. If you lay part of the pun.
I'm not a big fan of this. I think we don't have a problem with the back rowers down at Parramatta. I mean, we are losing a whole bunch of backup players in who can fill in that back row positions. But I'm not huge on signing Bryce Cartwright. I mean, we'll see what he can do. He's not going to come in and have an impact straight away on the team because he's not going to be starting over Lane or Madison, who have definitely proved their value to the team. In my opinion, two of the most valuable players on our team based off the last year. So it will be interesting to see what they do with him, whether he comes in as that 13th man kind of backup role to slot in there after a few of the big fellas get tired. In the middle. But yeah, I mean, I think Paramount have a few other issues to sort out, really. I still want to see a little bit more action in the halves, but, you know, halves aren't in their plentiful supply right now. So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I trust the fellas upstairs to get this one on the right track, and I think they have a plan and a reason in mind, so I'm just going to trust right now. But I wouldn't have done it. If I was, you know, playing Rugby League Live 4 and I was doing the little little manager mode or whatever it's called, I wouldn't be picking the Nebraska right.
Maybe they've got him as a backup half to Mitchell Moses after his performance.
Mate,
in that semi-final.
Junior Paulo should be playing half.
But moving on there, that's enough Para chat for the rest of the day. Yeah.
Yeah.
Josh Addo-Carr. Now, this one's a bit close to the heart.
Straight onto the Tiger chat.
Straight onto the Tiger chat. This one hits hard. I just want to announce, it's been announced that he signed a heads of agreement. We all know a heads of agreement is an intention to sign. It's not actually a sign. So until it's officially announced, I will not sleep easy. But this is a critical addition to the Tigers squad. With him, we become, as a winger or fullback, I think we become a top eight chance. And it's been ages. I can't remember the last player that we signed. We signed an Australia and New South Wales player in their prime who's just helped deliver a second premiership to Melbourne in his 4 years down there. He grew up supporting the West Tigers. I know there's been a connection with him and South, you know, Latrell and South being the proud Indigenous club that it is. But let West have their own history with Indigenous players. Larry Quarra and a variety of others over the years. This just has to get done. It needs to get done. And I'm sick of waiting around for it. And Melbourne, as I said, one of my beef for the weeks earlier, if this was any other club, if this was West, they'd be saying, oh, play well for you, play well for you. But now they're saying, oh, it's great to see Melbourne staying strong, you know, in the negotiation for a player. No, the player wants to leave your club. We're in the position of strength here. Go ahead and do the right thing and release him because he wants to get back to Sydney, and we'll see him in a black, white and gold. I'm 95% confident that we'll see him in the black, white and gold in 2021. But stranger things have happened, and being a Tigers fan, you can never be confident.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited for you, mate, but I don't share the same enthusiasm based on the impact you think he's going to have on the team. Personally, don't kill me after this episode finishes. But yeah, I think Josh Addo-Carr's a game changer, but he's a game changer playing off the people around him. And I at the moment, I think, you know, who in the Tigers outfit is giving Josh Addo-Carr the chances to do what he does in Melbourne, like Smith, Munster, and Justin Olam, even in the centres this year, did for him.
Well, I think Luke Brooks has been crying out for a fullback partner that was of a high calibre since the departure of James Tedesco. And those people who have recent memories forget how good James Tedesco and Luke Brooks were together as a combination. So I think...
But he's not a fullback.
I think he could be a genuine fullback.
But how long do you think he has to sacrifice 2 years of his prime to become a decent fullback?
I think he can walk straight in. He's got the fitness. There were no question marks over fitness like there was with Latrell. He can ball play. I've never seen him stuff on a two-on-one situation. That's what you got to create. The halves role is to create the two-on-one situation or the three-on-two situation for the fullback, and their role is to finish either by scoring themselves or creating the short pass or the cutout pass to the winger. I think he's capable of doing that. I think everything that he's put before him so far in his career that he stepped up and achieved, and I have no qualms of him stepping up to the fullback, and that's been supported by good old Freddie Fittler, the old snake, and also Billy Slater down there, and you can't have two better judges than that. So I back him in at fullback, and the way the contract that has initially been agreed to has been set up is that he gets signed in at $500,000 a year as a top grade winger, and if he has a good off season and performs and then plays more than half the games at fullback, I think that's a trigger clause, 12 games, then he can earn up to $650,000, which I think it's a good setup with the contract. And I just think, as compared to the other players we've signed in the past, I sort of knew Josh Reynolds, Russell Packer, you know, might be good for a season if they start on the park, but that isn't that longevity in the class that Adokar has, who's in his prime, play Australia, New South Wales representative. He's a must alongside with people like Jimmy Tarmow, Stefani Utokamanu, a young gun coming through from Penrith, coming across, as well as another year of development. You know, this is the move we've got to make. We've been pretty grounded in our approach, taking a bottom-up approach to our recruitment, but occasionally a time comes along when you've got to go out there and get the guy, and this is the guy, in my opinion, for the Tigers outfit.
He's definitely the guy. In my opinion, though, with the whole fullback thing, I say I give him to the Origin break to prove he's a fullback. I know that's a short amount of time, but I don't like dancing around what's real and what's not. He's the best, one of the best, if not the best winger in the comp. I give him till the Origin break at fullback, and if he's not helping my team win games, if he's not putting his true potential on the field every week, I move him back to the wing for the rest of the season, and he plays wing in Origin again. Because, I mean, it's not, I'm not an NRL player, but I know it wouldn't be easy to play all your games at one position for your whole career and then get put into another position, regardless of what you played in juniors or what you're capable of. But then coming into the best and the best rugby league competition in the world and being expected to be as good, if not better, than you are at the position you've played your whole career in. So I think he's a winger. Not saying his potential is limited, but, you know, I'm interested to see what the Tigers do there, and if they could work it out, it'd be really exciting.
Yeah. And we are getting close to time here, so we might just rattle through the last couple. Just one sentence as to where you think they could fit and why. Stephen Crichton, now, more than likely will extend with Penrith. He made a handshake deal earlier this year, but because he wanted to change manager. This seems to happen all the time. They want to change manager because managers promise them the world to get more money, and then they find out the money isn't there.
Yep.
Crichton, available for 2022. Dogs are interested. I reckon he stays at Penrith.
Yeah, I think he stays at Penrith. If I'm Penrith, I want him staying there. I'd, you know, extend a little bit. Young players are a bit risky to lay the money on for, but he's definitely proved his worth this year.
Benji Marshall. He's a young guy. Offered a $200,000 one-year contract with the Cowboys or a lucrative multi-year deal with Fox Sports Commentary Box. What does he do?
I go Fox Sports. I think Andy's career on a good note, where he started it here here in the West.
Cinque Docker.
West, Cinque Docker. So if I'm Benji, I don't go and do
a one-year little stint.
Yeah, one little stint. I mean,
with a team that's not in their window.
No one's going to remember it. They're not competing for a premiership, the Cowboys. I just think it's a bit of a waste of everyone's time. So, Benji, get on Fox Sports and give us your yarns, mate.
Love him on 360. He's got a great football brain, and I think he would be an asset to the team, unlike Braithen Astor and Cooper Cronk. But Johnny Asiata, heading to the Broncos, a one-year contract first, signature for Kevvy Walters, a big man who can ball play. I know you like these sort of players. Good acquisition.
I do. I love these sorts of players, but guess the I've only got two words for this young fella heading up to Brisbane. Good luck.
Good luck, Marcus from Tropoia. Jake Clifford. Now, he might stay at the Cowboys, but there's rumours linking him to Newcastle after he was granted permission to negotiate with other clubs. He's a bit of a crossroads in his career. Where do you think he stays in NQ or comes down to Newcastle?
Newcastle would be a good little change of energy for him. You know, as you said, he's at the crossroads of his career. So Newcastle is going to be very exciting next year, and there's going to be a lot of good energy there and a lot of winning attitudes. So, you know, if I'm a player who's at the crossroads and I'm looking for a re-motivation to get back to my best footy, I'm going to a team that's about to have a lot of hype around them, and that's Newcastle. So if I was him, I'd be heading down there.
And finally, another person at the crossroads in their football playing career is Jack Bird. Obviously signed to Brisbane on huge money. has barely got on the field. The poor bastard's been crueled by injury. Your thoughts on him potentially wanting to move back to Sydney? Does he go back to the Sharks? St George, he was a St George junior there. Got a contract on the table, a much smaller contract. But what do you think that would be the right move for him?
I mean, yeah, the poor bloke. Like he had it all cut out for him for a bit there, and then those injuries just set him back. I don't think too many clubs who don't know him, who he doesn't have personal connections to, will want to take big risks on him, especially if he still wants decent money. So I think I wouldn't be surprised if he heads back to Cronulla. You know, he's connected there. He's played there before. He knows a lot of people around there, I'm assuming. So I wouldn't be surprised if that's one of his main options and the best suited one for him. So it'd be good to see him get back into form down there in Cronulla.
Wonderful. There you go. There's our little fantasy picks for what we think players will be best suited for the 2021 season. It'll be good to see some machinations in the market, as always, in the transfer part of the season. But that's where we wrap up this week's podcast. It truly has been an enjoyment bringing you back after a couple of weeks' hiatus. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you got more informed about the Bushfire Royal Commission, as well as our little sports segment on the Grand Final preview, State of Origin, Grand Final review, State of Origin preview, and our market machinations. But until next time, stay golden, and remember, it's always substance over style here at Political Football, policy over politics.